kind are they?
I have no idea. We're at the Gallatin River just before it feeds into the Missouri headwaters, and we're watching a little school of baby fish. I don't know if that's what's called a fry. They're about maybe an inch to a couple inches long, some of them. And it's just fun watching them. However, I will say the river is really, really low. And right now it's Mother's Day, and a lot of people are out here enjoying being outside. So, hey. Well, Gallatin Valley and online listeners, I hope May is being good to you. This week, we dive into the archives and find a couple episodes good to listen to around a nice campfire or on a long brooding drive. First up, here is the episode from Ken Lane, released May 4th, 2018, and it's called Lonesome Cowboys.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Well, night has fallen on the desert. Thanks for coming out, everybody. We are here tonight in Palm Springs, shaded by these great mountains. And if you're looking for a place to live in the hot, low desert, being shaded by tall mountains for part of the day is very important. Water helps, too. Nice to have a source of water when it's 115 degrees, which it's not this evening. Thankfully, we are not there yet. Thanks for joining us at the Palm Springs Art Museum tonight. It's pretty fancy for a radio show from Joshua Tree. You might be out here thinking, well, how is he going to mix up Andy Warhol and desert conservation and desert preservation? I will do it in the usual way, haphazardly. Just sort of feeling my way through the cactus garden. Well, Andy Warhol grew up in Pittsburgh, and he spent his long career in art living and working in New York, city work, factory work, for many years. He was known for urban art, but he made more than 10,000 works that are flowers. His series of 10 endangered species screen prints, which are here, was made for the cause of protecting 10 endangered species. And there's an American bighorn, sheep among those. He made posters wishing the people of New York Happy Butterfly Day and Happy Bug Day. That's cheerful. And besides his wild 40 acres of beautiful Rocky Mountain land up the road from Hunter Thompson's Owl Farm in the town of Aspen, Andy Warhol owned 20 acres near the tip of Long Island, Montauk, a rustic 1930s fishing camp settlement on the seashore, surrounded by protected wetlands and cliffs and open space. It's a raw landscape with 30-foot bluffs and a rocky shoreline below, trees gnarled by the wind, a place that has been described as extreme, a draw for, quote, the souls of artists, writers, and musicians who seek the edge. That's from a 2006 New York Times article about the property, and it sounds a lot like the kind of press we're getting up in Joshua Tree in Pioneer Town today. Well, this wild seashore was Andy Warhol's favorite place, and he kept it like it was. This is what he said about it. I think having land and not ruining it is the most beautiful art that anybody could ever want to own. He said nearly the same thing to an Aspen Times reporter in 1981. Land is the best art. The Montauk House itself belongs to very rich people today, as usual, but the 15 wild acres around it are a nature conservancy preserve, according to Warhol's wishes. One of the last rare wild chunks on the tip of Long Island, the rare Montauk Moorlands. Now, there's a desert angle, too. There's always a desert angle. If there's not a desert angle, then it's probably not going to be on Desert Oracle Radio. Probably. Warhol was deep into his movie production routine by the late 1960s, and he and Paul Morrissey wanted to do something different, something on location. A factory character called Vera Cruz went to Tucson every year for her health. She had tuberculosis or something, a persistent cough. She wore a black leather motorcycle jacket over a white nurse uniform. She could take a car apart and put it back together again. Anyway, she wound up driving a lot of the factory crew out to Arizona. And they met up with Warhol, who flew. And from the airport in Tucson, they headed off. Bear Cruz drove this tourist bus out to, yes, to Oracle, Arizona. The same little settlement where Edward Abbey claimed to live, although he just kept a P.O. box there for fan mail and bill collectors, etc. The Warhol Cruz destination was the Rancho Linda Vista Dude Ranch, an 80-acre desert property with the kind of Western movie set up that you might find in Pioneer Town today. The movie wound up being called Lonesome Cowboys, an improvised cowboy costume melodrama comedy thing, offensive to polite society. It was more or less a William S. Burroughs Old West fantasy, a send-up of the all-American cowboy movie. Not a one-horse town, but a one-woman town. The men all handsome and interested only in each other. The action mostly consisting of standing around while making up a lot of deadpan, foul-mouthed dialogue. Now, the owner of the movie ranch did not really care at first. It was just a little extra income while he was trying to sell the place. He wanted to get rid of it. It had once shone a little brighter. Dean Martin and John Wayne and Rita Hayworth had been out there for movies or recreation or both, but westerns were pretty much over by the late 1960s, and the only good ones during this time were being made in Spain by Sergio Leone. So it was Andy Warhol who made the last western at Rancho Linda Vista before it was sold to a commune, a communal arts group still settled at this fine spot in the Catalina foothills today, 4,500 feet in elevation and ideal high desert land. Now, Warhol and Paul Morrissey hired a film crew with all the attendant grips and electricians and such, a fairly professional production overall, and the boys were coming up with some ridiculously dirty dialogue just as a tour group arrived to watch a real western being made, a real cowboy movie. As this will be broadcast on the radio, and that's one of the last things in America with any obscenity rules, I cannot quote the dialogue here, not the good parts anyway, but there was a lot of stuff like, "Why, I'll show you who the real cowboy is, you bunch of so-and-sos," etc. And the tourists were very upset. They were slapping their hands over the children's ears. They were running back from the western town in a wild panic. The owner was furious, and then Warhol describes the scene in his book, Popism, that was written with Pat Hackett. The grips, the electricians, and the people who build the sets formed a vigilante committee to run us out of town, just like in a real cowboy movie. The situation was tense, but a deal was made. The factory people would be watched closely, their every move, lest an orgy break out right on the dusty streets. Warhol says the sheriff's department came out in a helicopter, apparently ready for a riot. There was even a deputy standing on top of the Old West Water Tower, watching the proceedings through binoculars at a safe distance, I guess. It all got to be too much, and the shoot was cut short, and the rest of the movie was shot out in old Tucson. Lonesome Cowboys had been dreamed up as an excuse to go back to Tucson, in fact. Warhol and Paul Morrissey had a great time a few months earlier showing their films at ASU and the Tucson Jewish Community Center, and they just wanted a reason to come back. Tucson is very nice in the autumn and the winter months. And Andy Warhol should have stayed longer. Maybe had he stayed in Tucson all through the spring, maybe then he would have escaped the bullets of his would-be assassin, a violent schizophrenic named Valerie Solanas, in case she's here. She was creator and sole member of SCUM, S-C-U-M, the Society for Cutting Up Men, the goal of which was to eliminate the male gender. And while that may be a noble goal, overall, Andy Warhol was her target simply because he had passed on a play that she submitted to the factory. A play so vile and so obscene that he was convinced she was a plant, a narc sent by the obscenity squad of the NYPD or the FBI to trick Warhol into doing something offensive. Something offensive enough to finally be shut down. Finally be locked up for offending the morals of a country that would twice elect Richard Nixon as president. With Nixon's biggest victory, a 49-state landslide reserved for after the Watergate crimes were well known to American voters. Did we all die a half century ago? Can anyone prove it? Is this just a fever dream of a finished species, a ghost world on constant repeat with minor variations of the same devils and demons forever and ever? It sure feels that way sometimes. But I guess you could say the same thing about any period in history. It's like playing that old computer game, Sid Meier's Civilization. The technology changes, but people stay mostly the same. And good God, that's depressing. It's depressing to think about, and I think we should talk about animals. Let's talk about animals, the noble forms of life here on Earth. It's time for strange and unusual facts about our desert friends. The ringtail cat is one of the most delightful animals of the Southwest, sometimes called the miner's cat, because of their habit of moving into a miner's shack and taking up residence on a shelf or a corner somewhere, kind of like a stray cat. The way they may adopt your home as a no-obligations base for killing all the songbirds and ground squirrels in your neighborhood. And while the ringtailed cat also eats small birds and small rodents, it is not a feline at all. It is, in fact, in the raccoon family. And instead of the usual cat noises, hissing mostly, the ringtailed cat barks like a dog. Now, desert bighorn rams, they like to pass their time by smashing their skulls together against one another. Their skulls are, in fact, double. The reason this does not cause them obvious injury is because they have double skulls, double-layered skulls. Well, why not? The mountain lion is the apex predator of the Southwest and much of the Americas, and it is also not a lion, officially. According to human biologists who decide these things, the mountain lion is considered a small cat, apparently by people who have never stood eye to eye with the mountain lions at the Living Desert Zoo on a cool morning as they look you right in the eye and try to think how to get through that partition and to your throat. But the largest of the small cats, again, Desert Oracle.
Hey there, Ken, it's Brendan. How you doing over there? You're having a radio show tonight. Thought I would give you a call, see how things are going. Maybe we could discuss the issues of the day, and
Brendan,
maybe we could...
We were kind of expecting you here. I have a microphone set up for you and everything. We are doing a live show.
Yes, I was supposed to be there tonight, Ken. Unfortunately, circumstances have changed and things have come up completely out of my control that have kind of got me stuck at the house again, you know, another Thursday night, stuck at home.
Well, you're not that far away. It's a half-hour drive. Once you get in the car, I'm doing an hour. You can do the second half. We're kind of counting on you.
Ken, I wish I could. I wish I were just a half an hour away, but unfortunately, I'm a little bit further than that. I'm up in Victorville. Out here, as you know, Mojave Desert Industries has been involved with flipping houses in the superheated market that we're currently in, and I've purchased a bunch of houses out here, some of the subdivisions at the very edge of the economic zone, you know, where the prices really drop. I basically had it where I had taken over this subdivision. I was flipping houses and the vacancy rates were so high that half the places were empty, and yet all of them had automatic irrigation sprinklers put in by law. So I had a way to go to these empty houses and get the water going and use the irrigation systems to grow with a bunch of leaking water to saturate the ground into a kind of a marshy wetland where I grew all these Russian thistles. And I was just gonna let them blow down the street to the end of the cul-de-sac and collect them and use them as this set dressing for these projects that are going on at Coachella.
So you're selling tumbleweeds from Victorville to event planners and set designers at Coachella.
You know, out here in Victorville, I've been buying up a lot of distressed properties and flipping them. There's a hell of a lot of them out here in this area. Great deal, by the way, you know, as the bubble just keeps on building and the bubble keeps on expanding. These people got to, you know, just keep driving till they qualify. We're getting way out on the edge, but some of these people do qualify, and some of these houses are looking pretty good, ready to go with a little bit of paint and some light maintenance. My partners and I at the Mojave Mirage Real Estate Investment Trust have been making substantial investments in this area, which we believe, since we're right on the very edge and very end of the bubble, as that real estate bubble comes washes over the mountains and out here into the desert, back out to where it was in 2005 and 6, out in the Apple Valley, Lancaster, Victorville, we're seeing property values almost go up by an entire third over the last year alone. You know, they say people drive until you qualify. So we've purchased a bunch of properties out there right in the middle of turning them around, sprucing them up. They're not that old, only about 10 years old, and just need some cosmetic fix-up, maybe a grass out front and a sideways fence. That's where I am right now. I'm out in one of our properties out here. As we were waiting for property values to increase, I was thinking, gosh, there's got to be some other way to make money on these places. We really couldn't rent them for more than $1,800 a month. Well, I knew through some of my contacts in Hollywood, I know a production designer I met at a party down in Palm Springs, worked on this movie, or one of his friends worked on a big Hollywood movie with Quentin Tarantino, and they're doing a Western, and they need a lot of these tumbleweeds, because, you know, the tumbling tumbleweeds, Roy Rogers and the Sons of the Pioneers, that they needed that look of desolation, of longing, of basically desperation that you see in those Westerns. They needed the tumbleweed, which basically signifies that tension, that longing, that loneliness of the great Western deserts. It's a very popular motif. They used over 30,000 tumbleweeds in the production of that movie. So that's about 15 truckloads. They used it for filming, and they were paying something like, I don't know, they were saying $3 to $4 per head. That head is a Hollywood jargon for a single tumbleweed. Call it by the head. That's about $100,000. I had this plan to grow all these things, to sell to production designers for product releases at Coachella. Then I got undersold. I got underbid by a guy from Caltrans who works for their noxious weed abatement program. He got down to 50 cents a head. So I got stuck with all these tumbleweeds because I had to stop paying the workers. The winds basically came up. I didn't get to sell my tumbleweeds to Coachella. You know, the Russian thistle, as it's known, Salsola tragus, as its scientific name, is actually not such a bad weed. They call it a noxious weed. It's imported by some Russian farmers or something in North Dakota in 1870 or something. But hey, you know, without that Russian thistle, turns out that's what saved the cattle industry during the Dust Bowl, because that was the only plant that would grow and the cattle can eat it. So it's not all bad of a plant. It's got some good uses there. Turns out Coachella, you know, Coachella is one of the biggest musical festivals in the world. Huge impact on social media, people with purchasing power. Coachella is a place where some of the world's greatest manufacturers, designers, like to launch new products, get the kids involved. You got everybody there. You got those electric scooter guys. Range Rover released their brand new Mojave Desert Range Rover line there. These guys design huge events, big stars, lots of lights. beautiful set design to introduce their products. Well, it turns out one of these designers, name is Sergio Sesuali, they were coming out with this cactus and rattlesnake proof boot. High design though, that carbon fiber inlay, Gila monster lizard, they're gonna use the skin of a Gila monster as the upper. Beautiful shoe. They're using Coachella to do the product launch. They wanted a bunch of these tumbleweeds. So I figured I'd be making a cool $90,000-$100,000 out of the deal. Well, as it turns out, you know, the invisible hand of the market, you know, it's everywhere. You can't see it coming because it's invisible, but I guess I didn't do my due diligence. I didn't really research the market fully, or maybe who my competition was going to be. Turns out there's a guy who works over at Caltrans. He works in their noxious weed abatement program. And this guy, it's his job. It's his job to go around the highways and collect tumbleweeds. This guy's clearing 3,000 head a day and storing them out in Hinckley at the maintenance yard. And he starts talking to Sergio, and we enter into a bidding war. You know the thing about the bidding war, that's the invisible hand of the market doing its efficiency thing. And sometimes that invisible hand, you know, you can't see it, it's invisible. But it comes out of nowhere and it just kind of slaps you around, and sometimes it gets you by the throat and throws you down in the economic dirt. When we were running into cash flow difficulties there with these properties, not being able to get enough money on rentals, at that point in a business, you kind of have to decide who you're going to pay now and who you're going to pay later. So, of course, we want to pay ourselves now because we got bills, so we paid ourselves first. But these guys basically didn't want to show up and do any work unless they were going to get paid. Yeah. So I had all these tumbleweeds drying out, getting ready to break off. So I just figured, well, we'll let nature do its thing. And normally they just blow through. If I leave the gates open, they blow around the side of the house and go out in the desert. Don't bother anybody. But we got a pretty major crop here. They kind of jammed into the fence, into the gate openings. As fast as they were coming, I couldn't clear them. They formed this giant drift. Before I knew it, the whole front yard was filled with these tumbling tumbleweeds. There was really no way to get out of it. I couldn't really get into the front of the house anymore. The tumbleweeds had built up so quickly and with such aggressive force. I managed to get around the back side of the house and come in through the garage side door. Made sure to board everything up because these things were building up fast. I've been inside the house for the last 3 days, actually. I'm upstairs, and I can see out of the master bedroom window just over the top of the drift into the street below. And as far as I can see, it's just kind of like a large, yellowish, undulating mass. Like I'm looking through a giant loofah going all the way down the street for the entire block. And that's where I'm calling you from, and basically that's why I'm stuck here.
Well, I'm sure you've considered this already, but could you not go back through the garage door and get out the other side there?
Didn't really give myself an option to escape. You see, we had these garages, and we figured, well, we're just paying rent on these empty garages. We might as well use them for storage space. So we've already filled the garages and the sheds in the back and the backyards with tumbleweeds. We'd already gone to capacity. So there's going to be really hard for me to get out of the garage again now that I've got tumbleweeds both on the inside and the outside. And top it off, they've stacked up against the back sliding patio door. And it looks like I've developed a few cracks around the perimeter, and I'm kind of scared to go down there. And ever since the power went out yesterday, I've just retreated to this upstairs master bedroom. It's got a very big tub. It's very, you know, soothing in here. I'd like to be able to get down to the pantry and get something to eat, but I really can't because the tumbleweed, they breached the door. They breached the door last night. I was trying to keep them back. I had plywood up against it and cross braces, but they just kept pushing and pushing and scratching at the door. And, you know, a little tendril comes in around the side through the crack. And once that happens, once they get one of their tendrils in through the door, I think I'm going to be all right, though. I just got to wait until someone comes and rescues me. And I was kind of hoping, actually, Ken, you after the show could...
Police and fire crews have been rescuing people in Victorville from these tumbleweed walls right up there in that development. You just call the police, call 911, Ask for help.
I wish I could call the county and ask for help. You know, we all need help at some time. But now, unfortunately, county won't respond to any of my calls because I kind of went down this tax loophole wormhole, like a loophole wormhole, and how to pay less taxes. And, well, at the end of it, basically, I declared myself a sovereign nation last year and refused to pay any property taxes or income taxes. So the county officials and government agencies refused to help me. I'm kind of stuck here, Ken. I can't really call anybody because I didn't pay any of my taxes. Yeah, I could go around blaming myself like a lot of people do. Oh, it's all my fault. But I'm not going to sit here and play the oh, woe is me, pity me, I'm such a mess up kind of guy. I'm going to put blame where it probably belongs, which is the guys and gals up there in Sacramento. Now I'm upstairs in the bathroom, and I should be okay now. I feel pretty good up here, but you know what? It sounds like, oh boy, oh yeah, you know, it sounds like it's right outside the bathroom door now, Ken, and these are just hollow core doors. They're super cheap. I mean, they wouldn't stop a fire, and they wouldn't stop any noise, and they're definitely not going to stop these tumbleweeds once those tendrils get through. I'm, okay, Ken, if you can't get out here, I need you to get a hold of my fixer. Is a friend of mine, my lawyer, you know him, Oscar. And you gotta promise me you'll get to him and just tell him these words. Just tell him, the Salton Sea is rising. He'll know what to do. The Salton Sea is rising. I'm gonna have to get across the room here. I left my earbuds across the room, and I'm just gonna go over and reach him and get him out. Just hold on for a second. Hold on.
Brendan, stay put. I did text Oscar. I'm sure he will see it soon. Well, that was Brendan Mays, everybody. He's sorry he couldn't be here. Hopefully he'll be all right. Tens of thousands of tumbleweeds blowing over from scraped desert subdivision lots to the development across the road. It's almost like there's a downside to killing everything with a bulldozer. Well, from Amboy to Zizek's, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from KCDZ 107.7 in downtown Joshua Tree, and recorded tonight at the Palm Springs Art Museum. Thank you for coming out. I hope you enjoy the exhibit tonight, especially those big Warhol silkscreen prints. You know, Andy Warhol would pay bar tabs with his paintings and silkscreen prints in the 1960s, spend all night out with his ridiculous superstars and the Velvet Underground and Nico, and maybe the ambassador from Iran or a Kennedy sibling or two. And he'd pay the owners of Max's Kansas City with some fresh art from the factory. Well, that should cover another week of open tabs. These people hardly drank alcohol. It was amphetamine that kept them going all the time. Imagine getting that kind of multi-million dollar art for the wholesale price of a couple of dozen watery vodka tonics. Buy art when you can, friends. Buy and hold, as Warren Buffett says. But only buy what you love. Like a stray dog or a sofa, you should only bring home art. You should only bring art into your home if you are committed to looking at it for many years to come, despite the problems, despite your problems. Because once an artist is a sure thing, we can't afford it. This is what I've read, anyway. Sometimes I like to sit up in Joshua Tree and read Art Forum or whatever. You know, keep up with things from a safe distance. Thank you for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
And it's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM. Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. It seems like for years we've been in a loop going round and round, getting more than one version of, quote, truth, many thanks to the internet, I suspect. Anyway, things were much the same, though maybe the topic was different, when Ken released this next episode. From May 8th, 2020, here is That Which Is But Isn't.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and a lot of people are talking about UFOs again. Have you noticed? When the world's in trouble, when the news is bad, when society is on edge, well, then you know there will be UFOs in the news. It's just the way it goes. I haven't paid much attention to this latest little thing, the Pentagon again releasing these weird little grainy cockpit videos, which have already been released, supposedly by the Pentagon the first time, 2 years ago. It's all been dragging on for several years now with the usual goofball factor. Nothing really to be done about it. But because we tend to see narratives within the frameworks we already carry around in our minds, lots of people hear the Navy doesn't know what these things are, and it translates to, here comes the space ET fellas and their flying machines. And no such thing has been said. And it's not even news, as these tales of what happened way back in 2004 off the coast of San Diego have been bouncing around for more than a decade now. I first saw it going around internet message boards back then. Another interesting story from military pilots. I don't doubt they saw strange things in the sky. Lots of pilots see that sort of stuff. Not every day, of course, but get a drink or two and a pilot when they're off duty, of course, and you'll hear this kind of thing. If not their own personal experience, something shared. Something shared by someone they trust, maybe a co-pilot, somebody in their flight group. It's how the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind starts, if you'll recall. Control Tower. Air traffic is getting questions from commercial pilots about weird, brightly lit, strangely performing wonders in the sky. And then it's on radar, too. And everybody is kind of freaked out, but at the end, the pilots say, no, they don't want to file a report. Who wants that kind of hassle? You want to lose your job, end up harassed by UFO fanatics for the rest of your life? No thanks. Makes no difference if you report it or not. It's like seeing a ghost. Who are you gonna call? Nobody, that's who. There's nothing to be done about it. Weird things happen. Such is our world. Such is the human experience. Weird things have always happened to some of us, a lot of us. I bet weird things have happened to you. But we are in a goofy time, a sort of low IQ time, if you know what I mean. And I don't just mean the dummies. I mean everybody. We've got more physicists than ever, but none of them are geniuses, you know? Maybe Hawking was the last of that scene. The all-around brilliant mind. The public genius. Not many jobs in this dumb world require brilliance. You need a master's degree to get an hourly job without benefits. So we pump out the academic credentials like a sewage plant. All for naught. Who cares? You have a PhD? Great. So does everybody you know, if that's your social circle. And now you're all sitting around in your apartments or tract homes waiting for eviction or foreclosure, while the plumbers are raking it in, cruising around town, hanging out with their comrades. I've had some plumbers and roofers at the desert compound all last week spending my coronavirus stimulus on the local economy, trying to get this weird old place sort of semi-functional. Hanging out with the plumbers. Hearing stories about Airbnbs, about greedy people up in Oakland with scores of vacation rentals. They bought up all the cheap rental housing that used to be for the people who lived here. Made it all cute, you know? Polished concrete floor, little fairy lights outside, desert oracles on the coffee table, $300 a night. Now all these out-of-towners are unhappily facing the day of reckoning, like we all are. And one way or another. Anyway, I'd rather be a plumber than have a PhD with a $200,000 lifelong student loan attached to it. Not too smart, that ladder course. Make sure and put doctor in your Twitter bio, dummy. The time of the dum-dum. Look at the celebrities attached to the current UFO news cycle, small as it is. All right, there aren't any. There aren't any beyond this mook from San Diego who apparently fronted a briefly popular adolescent pop combo 20 years ago. Or a century ago in pop music time. An oldies act. I love good pop music like anybody does, and I also know when to turn off the radio because the dial has come to rest on the dumb corporate garbage setting. It's a cycle. It happens. It happens in everything. Books and movies and video games and architecture and fashion and theology, the long, dull product phases between the flashes of innovation and genius and inspiration. You get like a dozen years of top 40 that sounds like deodorant commercials. Summer's Eve, like ads for herpes treatments, feeling 7-Up, I'm feeling 7-Up, and then all of a sudden you get a Billie Eilish or a Madonna or a Beatles or whatever. A Nirvana, a Beastie Boys, an LL Cool J, and for a little while, the radio's good again for a spell. That's what it is when it works. It's a spell. You don't know when it's coming. Now let me tell you the kind of celebrity we had on the UFO cultural train in decades past. Let's take the 1970s, a time we know when things were especially weird. When John Lennon saw a UFO flying low and silent right over the East River towards the UN building.
Over here, up there, I saw a UFO, and it went down the river, turned right at the United Nations, turned left, and then down the river. It wasn't a helicopter, it wasn't a balloon, and it was so near.
And it looked what, sort of round, just, white, just luminescent, like, and silent?
Silent, and it looked dark, like black or grey in the middle, and had white lights, just looked like light bulbs, you know? Just going off, on, off, on, off, on, blink, 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 round the bottom, and on top was a red light.
John Lennon was in the zone. He was on alert. A guy who left the biggest entertainment act in the world, the first global phenomenon in popular culture, and said, well, I think I'll work on world peace. That's the life of the prophet. It's never easy. Two presidents who served back-to-back beginning in January 1977 were public and honest about their own UFO encounters. Ronald Reagan and his flight crew and his aides all saw the bizarre, big, glowing something that paced his private plane along the Sierra Nevada foothills as they flew over Bakersfield, and then it shot off like a bullet, disappearing into the upper atmosphere. Or, to quote the Gipper, straight up into the heavens, 1974. Jimmy Carter had his experience a year earlier, 1973, the year of the insane UFO flap over the American South. And like Reagan, he had other witnesses. About a dozen people were standing around outside the Lions Club in small town Georgia, socializing, when they saw it. Carter, a Navy veteran who worked in the nuclear submarine program, described his UFO as very bright with changing colors and about the size of the moon. The object hovered about 30 degrees above the horizon and moved in toward the Earth and away before disappearing into the distance, end quote. The size of the moon. Go take a look outside. At our waning full moon. Imagine something that big zooming around you before the old shooting star disappearing trick. David Bowie had communications and ridiculous sightings, sightings that were also witnessed by people who were not on Crowley cocaine benders. This was during the same great UFO flap of 1973. Might have been the most witnessed in history, spread out across the country and around the world, a wild time. The Oscar-winning actress Shirley MacLaine had her flying saucer experiences too, and like so many people affected by the 73 flap, her experiences would eventually involve pretty much every nutty thing: ESP, telekinesis, enlightenment, demonology, magic, visions. All this while the Stanford Research Institute and ARPANET and remote viewing and Uri Geller business was happening, with societal stresses expressed as plasma blobs of light and energy and archetypal forms. It really had it all. It had everything except physical spacecraft from other worlds or dimensions or etc. The only difference between the great wave of visions of the mid-20th to early 21st centuries and the visions of the past is that we began spaceflight ourselves. And we created the templates for both human spaceflight and alien encounters in the science fiction that began with Wells in the late 19th century and really ramped up by the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War, on the dawn of the space race. The sky battles that baffled the Roman legions would, by the early 80s over Hudson Valley or 1997 over Phoenix, become spaceships. Remember that Constantine saw an X-shaped fiery UFO and decided, or it was decided by a later Christian apologist, that it was a cross of Jesus. And so a UFO is credited as being the direct cause of Christianity becoming the official and only religion of the Roman Empire. These experiences were and are real. And I believe the flaps correspond to and or predict societal stresses and great changes. I'm not an original thinker here. The theory is Jung's. So the mystery drone panic that covered the American heartland and the Great Plains beginning in mid-December of 2019 and coming to a tremendous 1,000-mile-wide peak frenzy of sightings across seven states in mid-January 2020, well, what did that herald? Where are we now? What was coming? None of this is to suggest that intel, military, political, and aerospace actors are not involved in various ways, from outright psychological warfare hoaxes to plain old huckster attempts to cash in to various black budget but very physics-bound boondoggles from Skunk Works and their ilk. The true mysterious phenomena usually predict or coincide with physical technology, such as the mystery airships of incredible speed and power, electric lighting and dexterity, coming just as mankind's own clumsy efforts at airships were getting off the ground in the late 1800s. Or the black triangles which filled the desert skies before and during the development of our own high-altitude spy bomb jets that otherwise share no characteristics with the silent, hovering, low-altitude EMF-blasting plasma shapes that bedevil highway travelers with spotlights that spray a psychic mess of visions and ideas into the heads of the willing, and terror into the heads of the unwilling. We are in a similar time. The Tic Tac events heralded something, but they happened so long ago that what they herald is mostly past tense to our current situation. I think it was a manifestation of the decline of America as superpower, as felt so keenly by U.S. military personnel after the awful failures of Afghanistan and Iraq. This was a deep psychic wound, especially painful because 9-1-1 had created a sense of triumphant patriotism in those who joined the services during that era. Remember when George W. Bush stood before his mission accomplished banner a few months before Iraq collapsed into anarchy and Russia made its decisive moves in the Mideast? It was on an aircraft carrier off the coast of San Diego, home of Miramar Naval Air Station's Top Gun Cowboys. These same hotshots who would be utterly shamed and baffled by inexplicable phenomena in these very same waters, in this very same blue sky off San Diego, as the disastrous and horrific battles of Mosul and Fallujah were fought in November 2004, a few months after George W.'s mission accomplished television show from the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, That's when the tic-tac UFO bedeviled the Top Gun pilots flying maneuvers off the San Diego coast, November 2004, when we lost Iraq, when we lost the Mideast, when we became a client state of Saudi Arabia, second fiddle to petro-criminal states like Russia. Absolute psychic devastation. The ships involved in those incidents, the USS Abraham Lincoln and the USS Nimitz, traveled to San Diego from their headquarters in Everett, Washington. The Abraham Lincoln is one of 10 Nimitz-class nuclear supercarriers, the Nimitz itself at the top of that heap. The fire that did not burn, to quote Moses, is still with us, but now we insist on calling it a spaceship, calling them spaceships, because of our vanity, our self-importance. We have recently tacked together some spaceships, therefore everything strange in the sky must be somebody else's spaceships. Escal projection. We refuse to see the meaning in these events because we insist upon a science fiction theology spoon-fed to us from childhood by the likes of Disney. We are the dum-dums.
Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver.
You ever been to Farmington? Farmington, New Mexico? It's up in the northwest corner, just east of Shiprock. Shiprock, which used to be on the old Route 66, they changed it to Highway 491 a couple of decades ago, during the Satanic Panic. Well, that's a haunted land out there. Change the number, but the phone keeps ringing. In March of 1950, Farmington was the site of 3 days of mass UFO sightings. Half the town saw them in broad daylight since the creation of the Roswell mythology, starting in the late 1970s. When people hear UFO in New Mexico, they think Roswell. 1947, but there's a much bigger event in the lore, and it's lore you probably haven't heard unless you're from Farmington. The banner headline on the front page of the Santa Fe New Mexican, March 17, 1950, says, Farmington invaded by saucer squadron. Over in Las Vegas, the real Las Vegas, on the Santa Fe Trail in New Mexico, the Daily Optic newspaper of March 18 led with Spaceships Cause Sensation. In both headlines, the implication that the sightings involved some sort of alien visitors was handled with quotation marks. Invaded was in quote marks. Spaceships was in quotation marks. Because while the events were real, the idea that intergalactic pilots were buzzing small desert towns was just that, an idea. An idea from the comic books, from the pulp magazines, from War of the Worlds, from Superman. Superman was a space alien. That was a story, a science fiction story. Landed in small town America, dumped by his alien parents because they thought it was wrong to bring children into the world. Into a world like theirs. Although that didn't stop them from having children, people are weird. The space people we invent for comic books, they're especially weird. They're as weird as we are. Farmington's Daily Times had the most coverage, being the local paper. Huge saucer armada jolts Farmington. They put saucer in quotes. Being careful. Everybody called these visions in the sky flying saucers due to a copy editing glitch in Kenneth Arnold's earth-shaking UFO story from 1947. He described the things as skipping through the sky like saucers or stones skipped on a pond. The actual craft were boomerang-shaped. A bunch of them flying in formation at speeds that were beyond what any aircraft of the time could reach. And the way they moved, that was the part that was so unsettling. They skipped across the sky. Now they're here, now they're over there, now they're gone. The old trick. For 3 days, March 15 through March 17, the citizens of Farmington were dazzled by an ongoing sky show. Kids would run out of recess and spend the whole time watching the bizarre aerial maneuvers. Traffic crawled through town as people stood in the streets staring up in wild wonder. All the papers recorded sightings of hundreds of craft, hundreds. The one photograph you can see online shows a V-shaped formation of dull metal-colored balls, kind of lumpy. They were estimated at maybe 20,000 feet in altitude. Day one, people saw dozens. Day two, hundreds filled the sky, often in bewildering geometric patterns, including a strangely spaced column that filled a quarter of the sky, a column of shifting shapes within. Silvery disc with fuzzy outlines that appeared to play tag high in the air and streaked away at incredible speeds that appeared to him to be about 10 times faster than that of jet planes. They frequently made right-angle turns, and there was no noise evident, silent. A larger red object appeared on the second day, hanging off to the side of town, still and quiet in the daytime sky. Mock aerial battles were witnessed with the smaller craft darting around each other, playing tag, as some witnesses described, the aerial ballet. The business manager of the Farmington Daily Times, Clayton Boddy, described the, quote, red leader in the incredible sight of the sky filling with smaller shapes. Quote, all of a sudden I noticed a few moving objects high in the sky. Moments later, there were what appeared to be about 500 of them. Virgil Riggs, an elementary school student in 1950, gave this description to UFO historian David Marler. The first day there were a few, the second day there were too many to count, and the third day there were maybe 30 or 40 of them left. On the second day, these strange dots in the sky reached from horizon to horizon in a pattern that lined up like double six dominoes. From the newspaper, whatever they were, they caused a major sensation in this community, which lies only 110 air miles northwest of the huge Los Alamos atomic installation. What was it? Good night from the voice of the desert.
Busy place out here today. I love it. People, the river is low, and people are out there in their chairs, soaking their feet in the water. It's, yeah, a nice thing to do on a Sunday. Well, my thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver, and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers, supporters, and underwriters that support KGVM. I'd love to hear from you. Leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-404-6246. That's my Google Voice number, so leave a text or voicemail and I will get back to you. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgbm.org website. Watch those skies. Stay well. keep doing good things and sweet dreams. See you next week.